Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Ana Mateo. Later, we bring you the American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, the Higher Education Report.
The time of year has come again when college students in the United States who have completed their study programs celebrate their success. Every spring, U.S. colleges and universities hold a special ceremony called commencement to honor students who graduate. During the ceremony, the students receive diplomas, the documents that recognize the completion of their studies. Commencement ceremonies usually include guests who give speeches to express praise and offer advice to the new graduates. The speakers are often successful or well-known and well-respected in fields such as business, politics, or entertainment. Sometimes a commencement speaker is a former student of the college or university. The larger or more well-known a school is, the more likely their commencement speaker will be someone famous. The 2019 commencement season, for example, has seen many popular writers, actors, and singers speak on issues the graduates may face in the years to come. But few have gained as much attention as this year's speaker at the Morehouse College graduation ceremony in Atlanta, Georgia.
Morehouse is among a group of historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs. HBCUs were established before the U.S. Civil Rights Act of 1964. They were designed to offer higher education to African Americans because many schools in the country would not admit black students. Morehouse's 2019 commencement speaker was Robert F. Smith, founder of the investment company Vista Equity Partners. Earlier this year, Forbes magazine reported Smith to be the wealthiest African American in the United States. On May 19th, Smith made a surprising announcement during his speech to the nearly 400 Morehouse graduates in attendance. He would be paying off all of their student loan debt. On behalf of the 8 generations of my family that have been in this country, we're gonna put a little fuel in your bus, Smith said, followed by cheers from the crowd. The estimated cost of Smith's promise is about $40 million. This is in addition to the $1.5 million he donated to Morehouse in January.
22-year-old Aaron Mitchum graduated with a degree in finance. He told the Associated Press he had taken out $200,000 in student loans to pay for his education at Morehouse. He noted that in the weeks before graduation, he had calculated how long it would take him to settle that debt. His finding? 25 years if he paid half of his expected earnings every month. In one short moment, that responsibility disappeared. Mitchum said he began to cry as he sat among the graduates. "I don't have to live off of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches," he said. I was shocked. My heart dropped. We all cried. In the moment, it was like a burden had been taken off. Most American college students and their families share major concern about student debt and the rising cost of higher education. The U.S. Central Banking System, or Federal Reserve, reports that student loan debt reached a record high this year of $1.5 trillion. But Smith did not give his gift without expectations of his own. He asked the graduates to help others the way he had helped them, and said he hoped that every class has the same opportunity going forward. "Because we are enough to take care of our own community," Smith added. "We are enough to ensure that we have all the opportunities of the American dream. And we will show it to each other through our actions and through our words."
Helping others was the subject of several commencement speeches that gained national attention this year. Media leader and television producer Oprah Winfrey was the commencement speaker at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. She spoke about the importance of choosing to serve the greater good. "The truth is, you cannot fix everything," Winfrey said. "But what you can do, here and now, is make a decision, because life is about decisions. And the decision is that you will use your life in service. You will be in service to life. You will speak up. You will show up. You will stand up. You will sit in. You will volunteer. You will vote. You will shout out. You will help. You will lend a hand." Actor Kristen Bell spoke at the University of Southern California School of Dramatic Arts commencement on May 3rd. "When you respect the idea that you are sharing the earth with other humans, and when you lead with your nice foot forward, you'll win every time," said Bell. "It might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but I promise you it will appear exactly when you need it." I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore the origins and usage of common expressions in American English. And we are happy that you have decided to learn English. It is a good choice. There is really no downside in learning a new language, especially a useful one. But not all choices are as harmless. Some decisions have no good choice. Today, we will talk about those. English has many words and expressions that describe those times when you must make a choice, but all of your options are terrible. For starters, you can say you are between a rock and a hard place. This is when you must decide between two things that are equally unpleasant. Many cultures have their own version of this story, but one of the most famous is the Greek story of Scylla and Charybdis.
Scylla,
the online resource Encyclopedia Britannica, explains that in Greek mythology, Scylla and Charybdis were two immortal monsters. They terrorized ships that tried to travel the Strait of Messina, a narrow waterway between Sicily and the Italian mainland. Scylla is the personification, the human representation of a non-human thing, of sharp rocks and other objects along the coast. Scylla destroyed ships that came too close. Charybdis is the personification of a whirlpool, a dangerous water formation in seas and oceans. Charybdis also destroyed ships that came too close, but in a very different way. But both could kill you. And they were located so close to each other that they gave sailors an almost impossible choice. Avoiding Charybdis meant passing too close to Scylla, and vice versa. And that is what being between a rock and a hard place means. You are in an impossibly difficult situation with no good choices. So really, you must choose between the lesser of two evils. Now, let's hear this used in a conversation between two friends. A woman is planning a birthday party for her son, and a friend who offers to help finds himself in a dilemma, a real pickle, you know, a difficult situation. He has a hard decision to make.
Can I help with the birthday party?
Oh, yes. Thank you so much.
Of course. It's your son's birthday. I'm happy to help.
Well, I need to take my dog to the vet later today. But I also promised my son that I would take him and his friends out for ice cream after the party. So can you either take the dog or the kids?
How many kids?
Seven. Eight. And they will probably all be ready for a nap.
So they'll be tired and quiet?
No, they will be irritable and overexcited because they've had too much sugar.
Ugh, that sounds terrible. But then again, I'm not really a dog person. Is she good in the car?
Oh, she hates it. But not as much as she hates the doctor. She will probably bark the whole time.
Okay, so I can either take an unhappy, barking dog to the vet, or I can take a car full of overly excited six-year-olds out for messy ice cream.
Right. But I'll pay for the ice cream, and I'll pay to have your car cleaned afterward, no matter which one you choose. Well?
I don't know. I have a dilemma. I'm still weighing my options. They're both so bad.
I didn't mean to put you between a rock and a hard place, but you did offer. Now, you may have also heard the expression, damned if you do, damned if you don't. This may sound the same as being between a rock and a hard place, but we use it a little differently. If you are damned if you do, damned if you don't, it means that no matter what you do, someone is going to be angry or upset with you. Being between a rock and a hard place involves your choosing between two terrible choices. Now, whenever you have to choose between these expressions, you will know which one to use. And luckily, choosing between them will not put you between a rock and a hard place. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Between a rock and a hard place, whether I like it or not, I'm digging my grave. Friends ask me why I choose to stay between a rock
and a hard place. Well, I ain't getting younger now. I'm fading like a setting sun. I ain't strong.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In recent programs, we talked about how the rise of fascist leaders in Europe threatened American neutrality in the 1930s. Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party in Germany created the most obvious threat. But there was also Benito Mussolini in Italy and Francisco Franco in Spain. These leaders challenged both the idea of democracy and the security of some of America's closest allies. Hitler's invasion of Poland and the spread of war in Europe in 1939 made Americans wonder if they could remain neutral much longer. The United States would finally go to war against Hitler and the other Axis nations. But its first battle would not be in Europe at all. Instead, the United States would enter World War II following a surprise attack by Japan on the large American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Relations between the United States and Japan had grown steadily worse throughout the 1930s. Both nations were important industrial powers, but they had very different ideas about the economic and political future of East Asia, especially China. Until the late 1800s, Japan had been a nation with ancient political traditions and little contact with the Western world. Visits by Commodore Matthew Perry and American warships helped open Japan to trade with the United States and other nations in the 1850s. And in the years that followed, Japan took major steps toward becoming a modern industrial nation. By the 1920s and 30s, Japan was a strong country, but it lacked oil, rubber, and other natural resources of its own. For this reason, Japanese political leaders looked with envy at the Dutch, French, and British colonies across Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And Japanese business leaders saw huge markets for their products in nearby countries like Korea and China. Japan's desire to use East Asia to gain natural resources and sell manufactured products was in direct conflict with American plans for Asia. This was especially true concerning China. Washington created an open-door policy toward China. It wanted to keep China's natural resources and markets free from control by Japan or any other nation. For this reason, Americans were very concerned when Japanese forces invaded the Manchuria area of China in 1931. And they watched with great interest the efforts of Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek to oppose the Japanese invaders. The United States was also very concerned about protecting its imports of oil, tin, and rubber from Southeast Asia. This area of the world was a major supplier of these resources in the 1930s. The Middle East had not yet become a leading producer of oil. In these ways, the United States and Japan were competing for the same resources and Asian markets. However, there also was a good deal of trade between the two nations. In fact, Japan depended on the United States for most of its metal, copper, and oil. This trade with Tokyo became a major concern for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Congress in 1937. In the summer of that year, more Japanese troops moved into China. They quickly captured much of the Chinese coast. Much of the metal, oil, and other materials that Japan used for its war effort in China came from the United States. Americans did not like selling Japan materials to use against China, but the trade was legal because of a 1911 agreement between Tokyo and Washington. However, the American government told Japan in 1939 that it would end the earlier agreement. It would no longer sell Japan materials that could be used for war. Washington's decision made the Japanese government think again about its expansionist plans, and the announcement a month later of a non-aggression treaty between Germany and the Soviet Union gave Tokyo even more cause for concern. The Soviet Union could be a major opponent of Japanese expansion in East Asia, and it appeared free from the threat of war in Europe. These two events helped moderates in the Japanese government to gain more influence over foreign policy. A moderate government took power in January 1940. However, this period of moderation in Tokyo did not last long. In the spring of 1940, Germany launched its Blitzkrieg, or lightning invasion of Europe. The Nazis captured Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and finally France. Extremists in the Japanese government saw the German victory as their chance to launch their own attack on European colonies in Asia. They quickly began negotiations with Hitler to form a new alliance, and within months, militant leaders overthrew the moderate government in Tokyo. The new Japanese government was headed by a moderate, Prince Konoye, but the Minister of War was an expansionist, General Tojo. Tokyo wasted no time in taking action. It forced France to give Japan permission to occupy northern Indochina. And Tokyo also demanded that Britain close the Burma Road to the Chinese city then known as Chongqing. The Burma Road was a major route by which the United States was supplying China with munitions as part of the Lend-Lease Act. These events caused relations between Tokyo and Washington to become even worse. In the second half of 1940, President Roosevelt banned the export of metal and oil products to Japan. His administration also lent money to China. America began to supply Chiang Kai-shek's government with a fleet of P-40 fighter airplanes with volunteer pilots led by Army aviator Claire Chennault to train Chinese pilots. The squadron became known as the Flying Tigers. American representatives quietly began to meet with British and Dutch officials to discuss joint defense plans for possible Japanese attacks in the Western Pacific. Washington and Tokyo held long negotiations in 1941. The American officials hoped the negotiations might delay Japan from launching an attack to the south. They also thought that a delay might give more moderate leaders in Japan a chance to gain more influence. And, for a time, the American plan worked. Japan did not make new acts of aggression. Again, events in Europe caused this situation to change. Nazi Germany attacked the Soviet Union in the middle of 1941. This prevented Moscow from doing any fighting on its eastern borders, so Japanese troops were free to invade southern Indochina. President Roosevelt reacted to Japan's invasion of Indochina by taking three major steps. First, he took control of all Japanese money in the United States. Second, he brought the armed forces of the Philippines under American command. And third, he closed the Panama Canal to Japanese shipping. Once again, a conflict developed between moderates and extremists in the Japanese government. More moderate leaders, such as Prime Minister Konoye, urged one more effort to reach an agreement with the United States. But the Japanese Army and Navy believed that the time had come to go to war to end American and European power in East Asia forever. Negotiations between Japan and the United States continued through the final months of 1941, but the two nations were on the edge of war. They were as close to hostilities as Washington was with the Nazi government in Berlin. American military officials captured secret messages from Japan during this time. They learned that Tokyo was planning an attack of some kind unless the United States suddenly changed its policies. However, the American officials could not discover exactly where or how the attack would be made. Almost everyone in Washington expected that the Japanese would attack south of Japan. They were wrong. The military leaders in Tokyo were planning a surprise attack on America's main Pacific military base at Pearl Harbor.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.